This episode of To the Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Robert Picardo, the emergency medical hologram from Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To the Journey. I'm your co-host, Suzanne Williamson, and with me, as always, is...
Zachary Frewley.
Well, today we're going to be discussing the Season 5 episode Nothing Human. And if you need a little refresher on what that episode is about, it's where this alien parasite attaches itself to B'Elanna's neck, and the Doctor has to use a holographic Cardassian physician to help him free B'Elanna of said parasite.
So when we were trying to pick the topic for today's episode, I said, Suzanne, how about we talk about One Small Step? I love that episode. And you said, no, I hate that episode. It's boring. And you said, how about Nothing Human? And I said, okay, I think that one's kind of boring. But you won, and we're talking about Nothing Human.
And of course, after I rewatched it again, I was like, why did I pick this? In my brain, it was better than the episode I watched. So I don't know what I was remembering, but... it wasn't Nothing Human.
No, it's actually a great episode because it does deal with all kinds of interesting ethical issues and, you know, questions of morality and medical ethics. It's a really great episode. I just don't actually enjoy the episode.
No, it's a great episode for Metatrex. I don't know that it's a great episode for To the Journey because, as everybody knows, yes, I'm not that deep. I don't have much to say about that.
Well, obviously.
Well, yeah.
I guess that's it exactly. It's a great Metatrex episode. I'm not sure it's a great To the Journey episode to talk about. There's some great stuff in this episode, though. I had forgotten about. I had forgotten about the Doctor's slideshow presentation at the beginning of the episode, which is amazing.
Me too. And Chakotay disobeying direct orders.
Haven't you always wanted to see a Vulcan reproductive gland?
No. No, I haven't.
Up close?
I have always wanted to see Tom covered in mud, though. So that was good.
Well, we always knew Tom liked to roll around in the mud.
He was pushed, remember? He was pushed.
Sure. Must be it. Sounds like retconning to me. I'd also kind of forgotten about the conversation at the end of the episode between Janeway and B'Elanna, when B'Elanna's really mad and angry that her wishes were disregarded, and Janeway comes to her saying, it's unacceptable that you that we were going to lose you, so I had to do what I had to do. I'm sorry you didn't like it, and you're going to have to just get over it at some point. I thought it was a great discussion at the end. I'd forgotten about that little scene.
It was good, but I really want to know what that crazy Klingon incense smells like that she was burning. I really want to know what that smells like, because the captain walked in and she's like, whoa, God, what is that?
You don't usually think of B'Elanna as sulking to incense. Tuvok would do that. If he were in a Vulcan way, a stoic Vulcan way, he would go in his quarters and he would light some incense and he would sit there and he would, you know, do his private Vulcan sulking.
You just said Tuvok would sulk? Man, that's
he totally
up.
Would.
No, he wouldn't.
He would brood in his quarters.
He would be very introspective in a Vulcan way. He would not be sulking.
Yeah, no, he would look introspective, but really he'd be sulking with incense.
You were going to get some angry letters from a bunch of Vulcans.
And we know B'Elanna sulks. She gets in her moods. Mm-hmm. But I don't think of her as lighting a candle when she does.
Well, it wasn't a candle. It was incense. Incense is different.
That's true. Same idea, though.
No. No, incense you usually pair along with some herbal refreshment.
What kind of herbal refreshment was she having with her incense?
We just missed that part, I'm guessing.
It must have been there.
Maybe that's what smelled so bad. And it wasn't the incense. She was just blaming the incense.
I think one thing that's interesting about that scene is that it's really been a long time at that point in Voyager since B'Elanna and Captain Janeway had much of an issue with each other. Yeah, they had kind of strife early on. B'Elanna was headstrong and Captain Janeway, you know, promoted her to chief engineer, trying to mold her a little bit into being a little more Starfleet-like. We know B'Elanna's always has a temper and, you know, is a little moody. But it had been a while since we'd seen any real tension between Janeway and B'Elanna. Getting back to the Doctor's slideshow for just a minute before we get into the meat of this episode, doesn't the Doctor remind you of pretty much everyone's uncle? You know, the uncle who goes on a trip, comes back and wants to show his 200 pictures from his vacation or his adventures or whatever.
I didn't have that kind of uncle. No, I did not.
Doesn't have to be an uncle, per se. Some relative.
No, I didn't have any family member like
that. Everyone has someone who's like this. Let me show you all my pictures.
No.
Well, maybe you're the one. Do you do that?
No, because I just went on vacation and I haven't posted any pictures anywhere or showed people.
Okay. That's true. I have not seen 200 pictures from your recent beach vacation. Yeah.
And I have at least 200 pictures.
We'll put a slideshow together, would you?
No. I'm not going to be that person.
Don't keep us in suspense. It is really funny that Chakotay disobeys orders and punishes everyone else to sit through the Doctor's presentation.
Well, he had to sit there for 2 hours. He wasn't going to, you know, let them get away with getting out early.
Why is the Doctor doing this in batches? Why is he only showing like 10 people at a time this presentation so we can have small group discussion?
Well, that's probably the only amount of people you can get off of duty shift at a time and keep the ship still running.
You know what I did notice when I was watching this episode, and I never really noticed this. I guess I knew it, but I never really paid attention to it. But the angles that they show the holodeck in this episode really show how small the Voyager holodeck is compared to, say, the Next Generation's holodeck. It's a really small room.
You don't really need a large room because it's a holodeck. It, you know, kind of moves along as you do.
But here's the holodeck conundrum. What if you have two people in the holodeck and they need to be far away from each other inside the program? How does the holodeck make it look like those two people are really far away when really they're only about 10
optics.
Feet away? Parallax.
Optics. It's all about the angles.
Space yes. Optics.
Kind of like when you can take a picture leaning on the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but you're not really leaning on the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
So you could be yelling across the holodeck, like, hey, Harry! You know, if it's Tom yelling at Harry inside Fairhaven or something. And really, you'd only be about 10 feet away, but you'd still be yelling at each other because somehow the holodeck makes it look like you're really far away. It makes it sound like you're really far away, but really, you're just right there up in each other's business.
That's what the holodeck does. Don't question the holodeck or how it works. It just does.
But I guess I just never really noticed how small of a room it actually is. And I guess I knew it, but I never. This episode really showed the angles that showed how small.
Well, we don't really know which one they're in because don't they have two?
Is there a bigger one and a smaller one?
Could be.
Kind of like your own private holo room?
Why not?
Like a holodeck and a holo suite?
I don't know. Maybe one is just bigger than the other. That's all I'm saying.
Something to investigate in a future rewatch.
You go ahead and do that. I will skip that.
Yeah, that sounds like the kind of thing I'm going to spend time to do.
Report back to me with that information. Thank you.
Sure. Homework assignment, sure. Well, speaking of the holodeck, let's dive in and talk about the meat of the episode. Why exactly do you think they need a holographic Krell Maset in this episode? I know the reasons they give in the episode. I just think of all the things in this episode that don't make sense to me, why exactly the Doctor isn't smart enough to just read the database himself instead of coming up with this holographic Doctor to absorb the database or whatever silly reason they give.
I think because
it's a plot device. I get it, but
well, that, but It's also easier to come up with different ideas when you're bouncing ideas off of another person, as opposed to just sitting down reading a book. Some people's brains just work better that way, having someone to volley things off of.
So we've got another Geordi LaForge, Leah Brahm situation going on.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. Except it's the Doctor and Cardassian Joseph Mengele.
So in the episode, they basically say that the Doctor doesn't have enough room in his program to absorb the entire exobiology database. But you're saying it's more has more to do with this dialectical need to brainstorm and collaborate and bounce ideas off of each other, and which is fruitful. Mm-hmm. I mean, good ideas always come from discussion like that, so that's a very productive way to come up with a new idea. Why does it have to be Krell-Macet? Can't they, you know, yes, it was Krell-Macet's research, but couldn't they have solved the entire, most of the moral issue in this episode by making it not Krell-Macet? Couldn't they have picked a different doctor and just taken Krell-Macet's research and plunked
it into a different...
Exactly,
they could have taken some sort of human or Bajoran and named them...
Dr. McCoy.
No, but named them something similar to Krell-Macet. Maybe Morel Coset. Just mix up the name enough so people are like, oh, okay. Just don't make him Cardassian when you have a bunch of Maquis on your ship. He really didn't think that through very well. And I partly blame Harry, because Harry was right there when he was creating the holographic character. Harry could have made a suggestion. Hey, there's a lot of Maquis on the ship. Let's just change this up a little. We don't have to keep the exact doctor, just all the information.
Well, Harry did bring it up. He said, you do realize he's a Cardassian. There are a lot of people on the ship who aren't going to appreciate it.
Yeah, he brought it up, but he didn't do anything about it. Bad Harry. Very bad Harry.
But the doctor raised a really good point, which is that it's just a hologram. Who cares? If we can save B'Elanna's life, what the heck difference does it make?
Everybody cares. I mean, they didn't want to be treated by him when he was first brought online. What makes them think they're going to readily accept this hologram of a Cardassian who killed a lot of people?
Well, there are two things there. One is, when did everyone on Voyager get so prejudiced in the first place, where they're worried about whether someone's Cardassian or not?
They started out that way.
Yes, we have some former Maquis. I get it.
So they've always been that way against Cardassians.
Because of the Maquis.
Maquis, and remember when it was revealed that Seska was a Cardassian? Yeah. So they don't have a good track record when it comes to Cardassians, so they're a little shy about, you know, embracing them.
The Federation does have some pretty strong anti-Cardassian prejudices, like Chief O'Brien in The Next Generation. You know, he was strongly anti-Cardassian in The Next Generation. So that's one thing. Why is it such a big deal that he's Cardassian in general? It's a little prejudice, a little racist. Okay. The second thing is, why should holographic Krell-Macet be responsible for the actions of the real Krell-Macet? He is still just a hologram. He didn't do the things that the real Krell-Macet did. He doesn't even remember doing those things. Mm-hmm. So why on earth should he be held responsible for those things? Granted that he's a semi-sentient hologram, more like the Doctor, you know, a sentient hologram versus a puppet or non-sentient hologram. Holographic Krell-Macet says as much in the episode. He says, I don't remember doing that research. I don't remember doing those experiments. That's not part of my program. So why on earth are you holding me responsible for what the real version of me, not the holographic version of me, did?
So you'd be okay with, say, a holographic version of Joseph Mengele being brought about to save your life or save the life of someone you care deeply about? You'd be okay with that? Or even H.H. Holmes?
Well, I think there's two separate issues. One issue is this kind of emotional resentment that B'Elanna has towards the real Krell-Macet and ipso facto Cardassians in general. That's one issue, kind of the emotional, I don't like it aspect. And that I don't find terribly convincing, because if you can save someone's life and there's no extra harm done, I don't find that a terribly convincing reason not to go ahead and do the experiment or the new procedures, whatever. I think the second issue is a little deeper. The second issue is whether there's such thing as tainted knowledge. The fact that certain medical knowledge was obtained through morally questionable experiments, does that kind of taint the knowledge to the point where we shouldn't use that knowledge? We should pretend it doesn't exist, delete it, lock it away in a database somewhere, and never use that research because of its historical antecedents, because of how it was produced originally. That I find a bit more convincing, the idea that certain mm-hmm. types of knowledge are just tainted or morally specious based on its historical development.
Well, definitely tainted knowledge you should not use, because what's stopping someone else from taking it a step further? And then someone else down the line saying, oh, we can use this because, you know, so-and-so came up with it, even though it was not ethical. There has to be a line drawn in the sand. It has to stop somewhere, and we're stopping it here on Voyager.
This far, no further.
Exactly.
Chromoset makes this point in the episode, and I think it's a good point, that once the knowledge exists, shouldn't you use that knowledge to do as much good as you can? If you can save additional patients' lives, then aren't you justified in doing that just because it's good being done and the knowledge is already, you know, those the experiments that produce the knowledge are already done. That's in the past. We can't do anything about it. So let's do as much good in the present as we can.
So what's stopping someone in the present from doing horrible things to gain more knowledge? It has to stop somewhere. I mean, just because those things have been done in the past, and yes, you've gained knowledge from the experiments on people and what he did to them, doesn't mean that it should be used, and it'll get in people's minds, okay, we're using this even though it came from bad things. It's a slippery slope.
And it seems like the kind of thing you can regulate, right? You could use current knowledge to do good, save people's lives and whatnot, but you could still ban future research. Like, those are two different things.
And people are actually going to stand by the ban? There aren't people practicing in back rooms?
I want to know what kind of morally specious, dark experiments the doctor is doing late at night in sickbay now, after this episode.
Well, just ask his counterpart on the Equinox. He'll tell you.
You have to admit, it's pretty heartless, though, to know that a certain kind of knowledge exists, medical mm-hmm. knowledge, know that it could be used to save people's lives, and have to draw a line in the sand, like you're suggesting, saying, we're going to let someone die for the sake of standing on principle and not using this quote-unquote tainted knowledge.
Why can't that knowledge be found in a different way? Just because someone came up with it in an evil way doesn't mean someone else can't come up with it from a Hippocratic oath way, doing no harm.
I guess that's my point, that the whole notion of tainted knowledge is kind of a specious notion, right? Tainted. This episode kind of hinges on the idea that if you do a certain kind of experiment that's morally questionable, that taints the knowledge, and then that prevents you from using the knowledge in certain ways in the future. But if that knowledge doesn't have to be generated through those kinds of experiments, if there's a morally better way to produce that knowledge, then why exactly is knowledge tainted? You could just as plausibly say knowledge is just knowledge is knowledge, and it doesn't matter how it was produced. It just happened to have been produced in a bad way originally, but didn't have to be produced that way. So knowledge is just knowledge is just knowledge. So let's use it to save someone's life. Chromoset basically makes this point about medical knowledge on Earth. He says, you know, half of your medical knowledge is based on experiments on lower mm-hmm. life forms. Does that mean you should just stop doing medicine altogether? It leads to some pretty absurd conclusions.
Well, no, I believe that we should stop experimenting on animals. I mean, a lot of the things that are being done to animals now have been done for years. You already know how things are going to come out. Stop doing it. You can use computer simulations to come up with answers.
But the fact that some of our medical knowledge historically came from animal mm-hmm. experiments, does that mean that we should not use that knowledge anymore and we should stop doing the medicine that resulted from those experiments?
If it came from experimenting on people, yes.
But not lower life forms.
No, because most people on Earth see lower life forms as lower, even though I don't really, but I'm outnumbered, so.
Well, as Chromoset says in the episode, it's convenient to draw a line between higher and lower life forms.
Now, see, you came up with one of his lines, one that he says that really resonated with me with what's going on in the U.S. right now. Even enlightened races can't find common ground, which with our current political climate, we're not finding common ground, and we need to, desperately. We're all in this together. We need to remember that.
I think it speaks to just how radically different people's worldviews can be. Different nations have different worldviews, different individuals have different worldviews, different religions have different mm-hmm. worldviews, and, you know, they can all be enlightened, mm-hmm. they can all be mm-hmm. intelligent, they can all have something approximating civilized society.
And yet their worldviews can be so different that it's so impossible to find common ground. Even when you speak a common language, the background assumptions and the worldviews are so different that you're really kind of just talking past each other. You're not really on the same page.
That doesn't bode well for us as a planet.
I think that's part of the Star Trek vision of the future, right? Is that we can overcome that in some way, that we will find some common ground, and things like going out into the universe and exploring space can unify us in a way that nothing else in the history of the planet has been able
to. But we have to get past World War III first, if we're going to go by Star Trek.
And the eugenics wars.
No, those should have already happened. That was in the 90s.
Oh, good. Dodged a bullet there.
Dodge that one.
I was worried
about
it.
That we know of.
All through the 80s, I was worried about it. Weren't you?
That we know. Or perhaps it happened and it was kept undercover in secret. So only like the CIA and everybody like that knows about it. They kept it from the common man. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up here. So getting back to Krell-Maset, I'm on the side of using animal experiments, but not human experiments. But not really.
So we should let V'Lana die.
No, because Krell-Maset didn't use animals. He used people. He used Bajorans.
Right, which makes it worse.
Yeah, it does make it worse.
So we shouldn't use his knowledge to save V'Lana.
No, the doctor could have come up with a way. Come on, he's the doctor.
I guess that's, in all of Voyager, the doctor's like, oh, I'm smart enough to find a solution here. I can find the cure. And in this one episode, he's like, I'm not smart enough. I need holographic help.
I know. It's like, where did that come from?
It's so out of character for the doctor. I just don't buy it after seven seasons of the doctor going, oh, I'm the clever hologram. Smarter than the average hologram. I'll find
the cure. Even in the beginning, he was tooting his own horn with the slideshow. What happened?
This one time when I cured that plague, wasn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It almost sounds like Julian Bashir sometimes, actually. Dr. Bashir is a little, even almost more like that than the doctor. But I guess it just came out of nowhere, because usually the doctor's like, no problem. I'm going to go hide in my office. I'm going to dive into the database. I'm going to come up with a creative solution, something no other doctor in the Federation could have thought of, because I'm the unique hologram out here with all this experience in the Delta Quadrant. And he would find a cure. In this one episode, he's like, my meager little program is just not smart enough to dive into the exobiology database.
I just can't do it,
Captain.
That's pretty much what he was saying. It's like, no, he is our miracle worker. Come on.
You can program yourself to sing opera, but you can't read the exobiology database?
Yeah.
I can totally picture how this went down in the writer's room. They've got a great idea for an episode. Oh, let's have a holographic Cardassian doctor, and we can have the doctor and this other doctor kind of spar with each other on the holodeck. Mm-hmm. And it's a great idea. Why on earth do we need this other doctor? We already have a doctor. So now they have to come up with some BS reason.
I have a reason.
Why we need another holographic doctor. Okay, give me a better reason than what we did in the episode.
A better reason somehow. The doctor goes offline. So who has to work in sick bay?
That would make sense.
Who has to work in sick bay when the doctor's offline? Tom. Tom's not going to have any exobiology knowledge. So he has to go looking through a database. Comes up with a hologram he can talk to. There you go. I fixed it.
Now that would have made sense. Okay, so the doctor's... So in your rewrite, you're basically rewriting the episode at this point. The doctor is offline.
Doctor's offline.
And all of the conversations in the episode happen between Tom and
Krell-Maset.
Krell-Maset. Yes. Do you think Tom's not going to have any moral conundrums over this whatsoever? He just wants to save V'Lana. So I don't know. I'm not sure that would make the most dramatic conversation.
Well, no, Tom wasn't having any moral dilemma. He was just like, I don't care who it is, just save V'Lana. But I think when he saw, say he took the doctor's place, when he saw the parasitic life form in pain, I think he would have had issue with that. No matter how much he wants to save V'Lana, I think that would have been like, whoa, there has to be a way we can do this and save them both. Especially a first contact situation.
And that would be a dramatic discussion between Tom and Krell-Maset. Tom would be like, oh, no, I want to save V'Lana, but we can't harm this other life form. And Tom would still have a moral crisis about that. So that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make a lot more sense than the doctor needing another doctor.
Yeah, or even admitting he needs another doctor, because I don't see him admitting anything like that to begin with.
Do you think after this episode ends, the doctor just kind of brushes it under the rug, like, oh, I came up with this great cure?
Don't you think that's why he deleted Krelmoset?
To take the credit?
So he can write up the paper and he doesn't have to have somebody else's name on it.
He doesn't want his name to be second. He wants to be the name author. So exactly. He deletes the other doctor, wipes his name off the paper, puts his name first. He's in the clear.
There you go.
I come from academia. There are people like that.
I know there are.
Well, speaking of this alien creature that's latched onto B'Elanna's throat, mm-hmm. What did you think of this giant?
It's like a really bad Muppet, isn't it?
It is. It's like a giant lizard baby on the one hand. This is like a teenage lizard baby.
It is a teenage lizard baby, but Muppet version, because it's not slimy like the lizard babies were.
I don't really know what to make of it. It didn't look very convincing. It did look puppet-ish. Yeah,
it did look very puppet-ish. But it looked snuggly. I wouldn't mind snuggling with it.
Yeah, it looked like a giant, like, alligator stuffed toy you want to curl up with at night. Yeah.
So not very threatening looking. And I really would have liked to have, you know, seen them, the other aliens, you know, not just the one stuck to B'Elanna's neck. I would have liked to have seen them on the view screen. Do they stand up? Do they sit down? How do they move around? Are they on the ground?
Can't you picture on the view screen, like, three of them popping up like little whack-a-moles?
Like prairie dogs?
No, kind of. Like picket pens, maybe.
Okay. Then why couldn't the Universal Translator figure out what they were saying?
Because they're too alien. They're too non-humanoid. They're too diverse.
I don't buy that. It's the Universal Translator.
It's more like the Galactic Translator.
It's the Alpha Quadrant Translator.
There were some really cool ideas associated with these aliens, though. The fact that they can control their ships through some sort of biochemical means.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cool idea.
That made me think of Species 8472, though.
Yeah, they don't need opposable thumbs like we do.
They just need antennae, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, what do they do? Do they, like, plug themselves into the system with their little antennae? Do they just, like, stand next to it? How exactly does this work?
Do they emit some sort of slime that, you know, just attaches them to it like a barnacle? I don't know. Barnacle aliens.
Like little suction cups, like an octopus, or?
I don't know.
Just kind of kishwook yourself onto the control panel.
Unfortunately, I don't know, because they didn't show us them in action. Just jumping through the air and onto B'Elanna.
Are they like touch telepaths when it comes to technology? Like Vulcans, a little mind meld with the control panel?
Hmm. I just want to know more about them. And it would have been nice to have seen them again.
I love the cool ideas like that. You know, these aliens can control their ships through some sort of biochemical means. Mm-hmm. And that is obviously what allows this alien to jump through the force field.
Yeah, your force field didn't do any good.
There's some things that just don't make sense to me at all. Right. Like, we knew we needed this alien to jump through the force field. So let's come up with some, again, in the writer's room, let's come up with some way that this alien can plausibly jump through a force field. Oh, it controls the computer through biochemical means, so it doesn't have to actually do anything. It can just leap through the force field because it biochemicaled its way through it.
And why didn't it leap onto the captain? Because she was there, standing right there.
Why B'Elanna, in other words? Why did it...
Why B'Elanna? I guess it ties into the whole hatred of Cardassian thing. But I don't see Captain Janeway being all chummy with Cardassians. Especially after her past in the Cardassian prison.
Well, let's run with this line of reasoning a little bit. What if it had been Captain Janeway instead of B'Elanna? Would that have changed anything in the episode? Other than the fact that Captain Janeway couldn't be the one to say, we're saving B'Elanna's life, that's the end of the discussion.
Well, don't you see Chakotay saying that?
He would say that about Captain Janeway. Yeah, okay, that's a great question. Would that have changed Chakotay's view on the matter?
I think he would have prodded the doctor to come up with a different holographic doctor. Be like, there's got to be somebody else.
Just do a little cosmetic surgery.
Who's the second best guy in exobiology? I don't want the first guy because that's Krelmoset. Who's the second best? Who you got?
You know what they could have done? They could have done a Deep Space Nine Season 7 trick, and they could have just made Krelmoset into a Bajoran. Kind of like Goldicott turned into a Bajoran in Deep Space Nine Season 7.
Wouldn't that just be Seska all over again?
Yes, this is the Seska problem. Seska eyes him.
As long as Chakotay didn't know, because, you know, he's had issues with that in the past, so you don't want to bring those up to the surface.
So Chakotay would have been more like Tom in this rewrite of the episode. Chakotay would have been, we just need to save Captain Janeway, and that's the end of the discussion. I think he would totally change his tune about this episode.
I still say he would have asked for a different doctor, the number two in exobiology, not number one.
Second best, second skimmings.
Because even with the doctor and number two, they'd still come up with an answer because it's the doctor. Come on. And they're not going to let the captain die again.
I wonder who the number two exobiologist is in the Alpha Quadrant, I guess.
Well, you could always look it up on Voyager's logs now because they deleted Krell Moset, so whoever was number two is now number one.
Whoever's first on the list. Everyone got a promotion.
Yay!
Promotion by deletion. Sounds very Klingon. One thing I loved about the way they depicted Krell Moset in this episode is just how nice of a person he really was. He didn't act like a monster. He wanted to sing opera with the doctor. They had banter. He was a nice guy.
He was a nice guy. But I think that's just because he didn't really know who he was.
Well, he seemed to slip into evil mode pretty easily, though.
I know, but if all the memories of evil are extracted from your mind, you're going to be a nice guy. The inclinations are still there and you'll readily dip into evil, but you're going to be a nice guy.
So do you think the real Krell Moset was as nice as holographic Krell Moset? He probably was. He probably was this, you know, let's sit and have a cup of coffee and sing a little opera and then let's operate and do the experiments. You know, I think he could flip a switch and go back and forth from being a nice guy to doing experiments. I think that's what's interesting about this episode to me, honestly. I think Krell Moset, holographic Krell Moset, goes from I'm just an ordinary run-of-the-mill doctor trying to save my patients, doing some experiments, to, oh, it doesn't really matter what the consequences are as long as we can save our patient. You know, he just seems to flip this mental switch and go into evil mode at the blink of an eye. But really, he's a nice guy when he's not doing those things.
Can't you say that about a lot of evil people, though?
I guess that's my point. A lot of evil people are like that. They have this little mental switch that gets flipped. Yeah.
Because John Wayne Gacy, he was a clown and he did kids' parties. But then he'd also kill kids. So he was a nice guy, but he was a really bad guy. Really evil guy. What point are we trying to make that even evil people are nice? No, we need to move off of this.
We expect evil people to act evil all the time. And this episode, I think, makes the case that they don't.
No, I don't expect that. And I think that's what, in my mind, makes them more evil. It's because, yeah, they're normal, but then, oof. Don't get on their bad side. Because if they're evil all the time, that's just cartoonish. That's not reality.
So you seem like a nice person, Suzanne. I've known you for a while. But really? Really?
Yeah. Don't get on my bad side.
Hear that, listeners? Tread lightly.
No, I just like to study serial killers. I'm not really one, okay?
Sure, that's what they all say. Okay, evil Dr. Williamson.
Yes. Excellent.
So what about this question at the end of the episode about whether to delete holographic Krell Moset and delete all of his research? Maybe we talked about this already, but do you think the doctor made the right decision there?
If he really wants to be the only one on that paper, then yes, he made the right decision.
Supposed to be a serious question, but I know better than that, so...
How long have you known me now? I'm not that serious. But if you would like to answer seriously, I implore you to do so.
Well, I think Krell Moset calls the doctor out on it. He says, you didn't care about these things when we were trying to save B'Elanna's life, and now you want to delete me? You hypocrite.
He cared about saving the other life form. He pretty much yelled at him when he was zapping the thing.
But he didn't care about not using the tainted research.
Yeah.
So much. It's easy to just kind of step back after the fact and go, oh, we shouldn't have done that. Let's delete the hologram.
So you're against deleting Krell Moset is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's still just a database at heart. I don't think it's a real person.
But he is a real person, and he's the head of some department at a university.
Yeah, the real Krell Moset is not hologram Krell Moset. The hologram Krell Moset is just a walking computer program, kind of like the doctor, but the doctor is an above average computer program.
Krell Moset's intellectual property is... you know, for better or worse, on Voyager. And not even all of it, because they left out some stuff.
I think if we ignore the fundamental premise of this episode that the doctor's program can't handle the exobiology database, and the doctor were just smart enough to dive in and read the database and come up with a solution himself, no one on Voyager would have blinked an eye at the situation, and no one would question using the research. It has everything to do with the fact that this is a holographic recreation of this real doctor somewhere back in the Alpha Quadrant. If you get rid of that piece of the puzzle, I don't think anyone's going to have any moral question about this. They might. Maybe they should. Maybe the question of tainted research is still applies. I just don't think this sort of emotional component would be there. B'Elanna's reaction wouldn't be there. The Maquis' reaction wouldn't be there. And it wouldn't have come up. So why delete the hologram? He's still just a database.
If Tabor heard the name Krell-Maset, it would have triggered him. Because that name is so prominent in his memory.
We haven't talked about this very much yet. What about his reaction? You know, he's ready to resign his commission over this.
I know. Where's he going to go? There's not a planet nearby. What's he going to do?
I'm just going to quit and come along for the ride for 70 years.
I'm just going to hang out. So he's going to be Neelix? He's just going to hang out?
What happens if you resign your commission on Voyager? You could still resign. Does that make you a crewman? Do you have to serve? Can you just be on Easy Street for 70 years?
I don't think you can be on Easy Street. I don't see Captain Janeway being down with that. You got to be able to pull your weight.
I wonder what she would make them do. They would become a crewman, I guess.
If they resign their commission, you don't automatically just become a crewman.
Well, you're not an officer anymore if you resign your commission.
You're not anything anymore.
You could be like a non-commissioned officer, like a chief, or you could be a... I mean, they have the term crewman, right? Crewman, blah, 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 blah.
But if he's not going to be an officer, he's not going to be a crewman either.
Why would you resign to be a crewman?
Yeah, it's like, I'm done.
Where's
with
he going to go?
That's what I'm saying. There's no planet around. Is he going to hop in with the parasitic aliens?
No, he's going to hang out in Neelix's resort program for the trip home.
Oh, God, nobody wants that. Ugh. At least go to Sandrine's.
Or Fairhaven, or pick your favorite.
No, nobody really wants that.
For 70 years, I don't know if I can handle that.
Yeah, I don't see him being allowed to just mooch off of Voyager, which is what he'd be doing if he resigned his commission. Be like, okay, get out. We'll find the next planet and drop
you off.
So
it's kind of an empty threat. I'm going to resign my commission. Like, fine, you want to go scrub the plasma manifolds? Knock yourself out. Someone has to do it. Might as well be you. It's an interesting way to protest the command decisions. Like, Captain Janeway says, we're going to move forward with this research and save B'Elanna's life, and a crewman protests by resigning. I imagine Captain Janeway saying, fine, you can be a crewman. We don't really need you like you think.
But see, I still don't think he's going to be a crewman. He's resigning his commission. He's walking away. He's not going to be anything.
I guess Captain Janeway has the authority to draft people on her ship, right? She would just put him to work.
No, because then he'll just be like, I'm leaving. Next planet, I'm gone.
Jump ship.
Yeah. Why would he stay with these people who he's objecting to what they're doing?
It seems like a pretty extreme kind of protest. And I get what they're trying to do in
the man killed his grandfather and his brother. Yeah, that's going to mess with the guy.
Yeah, it was a long time ago in a half a galaxy far.
Dude! No. He still remembers the smells and everything. No.
Ooh.
Yeah.
They need someone to attest to how bad Krell-Maset really is, right? Mm-hmm. Because we really only have people's word to take for it. It's not in the medical database, yeah. Right? These experiments weren't recorded officially. So someone had to stand up and go, this guy is evil, so the audience believes it.
Mm-hmm. And that just happened to be Tabor.
Because otherwise, he's just a, you know, fairly nice, you know, semi-musical, holographic Cardassian doctor. So someone has to go, nope, he's a baddie.
While medical ethical quandaries aren't the only thing we've been discussing on the network, here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Literary Treks.
I wouldn't say it's totally different, but I would say there's some difference to it. Yeah, I did see some elements that reminded me of The Trouble with Tribbles, and yeah, you know, certainly I mud in a piece of the action, I can see that too. It does have that comedy element, just like those episodes do. But I think this takes it a little further and is a little more slapstick.
Very slapstick.
But again, there's certain tones and certain elements that do remind me of those other episodes. So,
Warp 5.
I do want to mention also that just something that this came up when I was working on Knights of the Living Dead. George Romero hated the word zombie and didn't think of his creatures as zombies. That
yes,
and it's one of the reasons why there's only some overlap between what we saw in Night of the Living Dead and everything you just described from West African and Caribbean folklore. Because of that, the two, basically, you kind of got, you know, undead peanut butter and zombie chocolate, and you wound up with what everybody now thinks of as zombies.
Meta Trex.
Just imagine the worst case scenario that could happen, and look at all the bad things that have happened in history. And then you realize, hey, even if the worst possible scenario unfolds, that's not too bad in the grand scheme of things right here in the present.
I was going to say, some people read Marcus Aurelius, Riker goes to the holodeck.
The 602 Club.
I definitely agree. I thought that the writer did a great job of portraying Han. And Han's a hard character to nail down because...
Mm-hmm.
I think it was really hit and miss in the old legend stuff with Han. There were some books that really glorified him as a character and tried to turn him into something that he wasn't.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join in the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are lots of ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation with us is in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, speaking of contact information, Suzanne, when you're not hiding in your quarters with some Klingon incense, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me occasionally popping up in the Babel Conference. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is KJaneWay8. And Zachary, when you're not cuddling up with a parasitic alien Muppet, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
What do you mean when I'm not doing that? If I had a parasitic alien Muppet, that's all I would do is cuddle with it. Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of Metatrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, where, interestingly enough, Suzanne, Mike Morrison, my co-host on Metatrek's, and I did do an episode on scientific and medical ethics, and we spent some time talking about this episode of Voyager and talking about Kralmaset and some other examples of medical ethics in Star Trek. That is Metatrek's episode 51 for you listeners who are interested in listening to me talk a little more about the philosophy of medical ethics inside this episode. Metatrek's 51. You can also find me on Twitter if you'd like to follow me there. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And you can find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Voyager with me in there.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. All available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, we'd like to take a minute to acknowledge the rest of our To the Journey team from around the network. We'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and whose holographic duplicate was always a nice guy. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And a special thank you and a shout out to our five associate producers here on To the Journey. We'd like to thank Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carlin, and Norman Lau. Thank you very much for your support of To the Journey and Trek.fm.
Well, join us next time where Zachary and I try and figure out how long we can sit through the Doctor's holographic slideshow before we call for a yellow alert. But until then, this has been To the Journey.